Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is Piper Jaffray, Senior Research Analyst, Gene Munster. Gene, good afternoon. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, John.
Hey, it's great to have you. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. As we talked about, I've been writing about you for years. I've been following your research and your analysis. And I like everything you've ever done. So
I appreciate that.
Let's chat. One of the things we do on Background Mode, as the listeners know by now, is we kind of talk about how things came to be. We go back and ask the guest about their background and their history. And so I'd like to ask you, start off in the first half of the show here, you know, everybody has this aspiration when they're growing up about what they think they want to do when they get older. How did that go for you?
Well, it has a surprisingly close resemblance to what I'm doing today. And I was, as a kid, always obsessed with business. And even to the chagrin of my parents, when they would take me to church, I would be more interested in how many people were there and how much money they were putting in the basket and what the costs of running the building were, and was more focused on that piece of it. So, and then as I was growing up, I was always involved in some kind of business. So at the core, I always knew I was going to do something with business. And separately, is I was a nerd growing up, and I think there's a distinction between a geek and a nerd. I think a geek is somebody who is socially with it, but very smart. A nerd is someone who doesn't quite have those same social skills. And the youngest of four boys, and all my three older brothers were all geeks, and I think that had a profound impact on things that I aspired to be, because technology and mathematics were a big part of growing up around the house. So, and I was fortunate enough to aspire and be doing something similar to what I thought of as a kid.
Cool. Did you grow up with computers in the household?
We did. My dad had a small accounting business, and so he was always kind of messing around with mainframes back in the day, and then when the personal computer came out. But I remember I am far from coordinated, but when the neighborhood kids would be playing baseball, I would take stats on them, and then I would go and enter it into a computer with these massive floppies that we'd have in our basement. And obviously, just the process of working with computers always fascinated me. And so I was able to convince my mom, as in third grade, for our computer lab at school, to get a job to volunteer there, because that allowed me to get more time. And those computers at the time did not have drives on them. They had actually cassette tapes, and the programs would load through an audio cassette tape.
I remember that. Yeah, I had an Apple II, and it used cassettes before the disk drives came out. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that just playing with those computers, and I think it just kind of one thing led to the next.
Your dad, you said, was an accountant?
He was. He had a small accounting business that basically helped doctors, was kind of the focus. And so I think that probably played into my interest in business, too, just hearing him talk about his small business as well.
Right, right. This is a recurring theme that I'm seeing with the guests, is technical parents, computers in the household, inspired by something the mother or father did. Awesome. So I guess this carried through your education then. And did you major in college?
Well, I think there's kind of an important small side or other step before I hit college, which mm-hmm. was when I was 12 years old, I started a lawn care business, which everybody starts and kind of plays around with it. And I think there are kind of three basic tracks in school. There was the athletes, and then there was the probably more the artistic type of people, and then there were the other camp, and I was definitely in the other camp, and I found a lot of my excitement about life was building this business up, and I'm proud to report we ended up building quite an empire over the next 8 to 10 years. And
awesome.
I took that business and ran it through college, and that actually was one of the reasons why I landed the job that I'm at today. Is one of the people who I had worked for a long time was also an analyst, and well, I would be working, he would invite me over and tell me about this business, and his name is Brooks O'Neill, and he ultimately made an introduction. So as far as college, what I studied was finance and entrepreneurship at a small liberal arts school, and I think it kind of also lines up with that business theme, and so I kind of progressed along that road.
Is this where you started doing financial analysis? Did you run your lawn care system on an Excel spreadsheet?
Well, it was much more intense than that.
Really?
My older brother, Jim, is a programmer, and he wrote a program for me in high school that basically was a CRM / kind of accounting system for the business. And so
now, CRM, that's customer relationship management.
That's exactly right. I would say that this, now we're going way back into the 80s here, but I think that I'm probably one of the best computing platforms of anybody in the lawn care business. So that kind of allowed me, with a lot of help with my brother, to kind of find ways to add efficiency into the business in terms of how we log things. And I love doing that kind of thing. And so it allowed me to learn a little bit about management, a little bit about computing, and learned, I think, a lot about just hard work, too.
What kind of computer were you using? Had you fallen into the Mac sphere at this point?
I had. In 1986, we got a Macintosh. And so this was, all these programs were written for the Mac.
Like, for example, can you give us a...
Well, the example, the program that my brother wrote was written for the business was run on, was written for the Mac. But, and then I would just use, everything from, I think it was Lotus, what we were using at the time. Don't hold me to that, but there was a form of spreadsheets, and also Paint was one of the ones that we typically played with. It was less about games, and it was more about than the word processing on there too. So it was pretty straightforward.
Yes.
Then.
So you did you end up financing part of your college with this business then?
I did. I think I did get about a quarter of my college was paid for through a grandparent, but the other three quarters was financed through Moyne Lawns. And it was I remember when I was coming to the end of my college career and was doing the math, and I had to take about a 50% pay cut to come and work at Piper Jaffray, and I remember thinking it's the right thing to do longer term, but it was sure tough. So it was at the time a great business.
So you went right out of college into Piper Jaffray. Did they actively recruit you, or how did that work?
Well, Brooks O'Neill, who I had mowed his lawn, as crazy as that sounds, but he kind of knew how diligent I was, I guess, with the business, but also knew what my grades were like in school. And he thought, if you ever have an interest in doing this, and I went and I met with a guy by the name of Haney Nada, who now is one of the partners at GGV, been ultra successful in the private equity world. But Haney was crazy enough to take a risk on me and hired me out of college to work with him and cover some of the software names. So those names, the biggest one that's still around, the biggest couple would be like Autodesk and Adobe. And a lot of those early companies were kind of in the multimedia space, some were with video editing. And so that was kind of the initial coverage space kind of in the mid-90s. And then as the internet started to take off, we evolved that, and I became a senior analyst around 2000, in part because there's just too much work to go around with IPOs. They didn't have enough analysts, so I got caught another huge break based on the internet bubble to get a chance to have my own space and cover internet.
Now, we know that you write research reports about Apple, but let's back up a second for the listeners who may not be completely familiar. Tell us about Piper Jaffray, the scope of what the company does.
So it's an investment bank. It's a mid-tier. So think if you think of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, we're a small version of that. There's about 1,300 employees. And our business is in part financing companies when they need to raise money and also helping investors make money. And that's my side, is writing research that helps professional investors that may work at Oppenheimer, Fidelity, or T. Rowe, or Capital Research, helping those people understand what some of the trends are and how those trends are impacting their portfolio companies. And so we have an area of coverage that's referred to as a universe. And my area of universe is internet and hardware. And so the internet piece is companies like Facebook and Google and eBay and PayPal. And in terms of the hardware side, it's predominantly Apple.
So those are the companies that you cover?
That's correct.
I've been seeing your research reports from Apple, but I didn't realize that you had also covered Google.
We do. If we look at our total time, it's probably about 40% of it is spent on Apple. I'd say a typical analyst will spend maybe 5 or 10% of their time on any given company, but just given the scope of Apple, we spend a disproportional amount of time on it. And I have two colleagues that I work with, and the three of us together cover those stocks.
Cool. Well, I think it's time to take a break right now. When we come back, I want to ask you about your specific work at PJC and Apple in particular. Folks, we're going to take a 60-second break. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO, or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. We're back. So, Jean, I've always been curious about specific duties. You have a list of companies that you cover in your universe, but does the company ask you to perform specific tasks that you are accountable for, or is it just up to you to decide how you want to cover the companies that you're assigned and then you do whatever you do?
Most of it's up to the analyst, and we have some big picture things that we have to do. For example, write a couple industry reports per year or meet with a certain number of institutional investors face-to-face every year. It tends to be about 150 meetings per year. And beyond that, they give us a lot of flexibility. And the core goal is to create research that helps institutional investors make money. And so that's the real mandate, is giving us some flexibility in terms of how you can be relevant in the industry and try to track and predict trends before most people know about it.
When you meet with those investors, how does that happen? Do they fly into Minneapolis to see you, or do you do a video conference? How does that work?
Well, typically it's us going on the road, so I'll just work with, we have an institutional sales team that calls on them, and we'll set aside a day and pick the city, and then they will set up the meetings, and we'll just kind of go from one meeting to the next throughout the day.
So you're on the road a lot with 150 of these a year?
Yeah, it's probably majority of my time is on the road. I'm tend to be in the office around earnings time when companies are reporting their earnings. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, I usually am traveling.
Tell me about how your day goes. When you get to the office in the morning, how is it structured? Do you have like a specific plan or how do you map out your work day? I've always been curious about that.
Well, it starts at 6:30 local time. I'm based in Minneapolis, and it is our morning call.
Wow.
And so
6:30?
I'll listen. Yeah, 6:30. And
wow.
Usually you want to try to be in a little bit before that just so you know what's going on in the news. And the morning call is something where we tell our salespeople and help them understand what's important to know in the news. And so we'll do the morning call. And then we basically start the research part. And I'll sit down with the analysts that I work with, and we'll map out what we think are critical pieces to get an opinion on. One of the beautiful things about this job is that the answers aren't very clear. That can be frustrating for some people. In our case, we take it as a challenge to go and find the answer and to walk through walls to get to those answers. So what we'll do is we'll sit down after the morning meeting and outline what the key areas of our focus for the day are. And I might be traveling and calling to the Doug Clinton and Sam Kemp, the guys that I work with. And we will start the process of researching. So some of those may be another example would be a third person we work with is Travis Jekyll, who does analytics. So he'll scrape different websites or track different trends about online traffic and be able to do correlations to different businesses. For example, the number of times that people search for iPhone, we can correlate that back to iPhone sales. But it's those type of things that will kind of lay the groundwork in terms of what we're doing for the day and what we're researching. And that will take a lot of different forms. And that's the majority of the day is working on that. And then in the afternoon when the market closes, usually there's some news that comes out after the market closes, and we'll have to respond to that news and figure out how that impacts our opinions on these companies. And in doing that, we'll have to write research notes that get published throughout the day. And so, and the typical day will end around 6 p.m., and then there's usually at night, you'll just kind of check in to see what's going on with the news.
So you can collect in real time information about a company as the day goes on. That's something I've always been curious about. You know, there's the 10K reports and there's the earnings reports that Apple does and Tim Cook reveals numbers. But to get at specific information about a company during the day on an ongoing basis, that's fascinating.
There's two aspects to it. One is we call lab work, which is publicly available information that you just described that we'll go through and analyze and get a perspective on in mm-hmm. the office. We call mm-hmm. it the lab. And then there's field work where we actually will either use different tactics to go out online or go into the field and survey people or meet with private companies that are having an impact or meet with the actual public companies and will help formulate our opinion. So really it's a combination of lab work and field work gets us to our ultimate opinion.
Do you ever meet with Apple executives throughout the year in addition to the call-in for the earnings reports?
I'd say we meet with a lot of the executives from our companies throughout the year, and so I would just kind of keep it very high level that we meet with all of our companies.
Just to sort of get a feel for what they're thinking and their strategy and what's happening with the company and so on, right? Just to touch bases.
Exactly. It tends to be points of clarification, and they're extremely strict in terms of what they talk about to make it sure that everything that they say is consistent with things that they've publicly said.
Mm-hmm.
And so it tends to be more for relationship building than it tends to be for getting information. Most of the information we get, the vast majority of it, comes from our own work and trying to understand, and then the part of it comes from the public information that's given to us, but that's the lab piece to it.
I remember reading about a project you were on a few years ago where you went to perhaps Mall of America stood outside the Apple store and looked at people buying things, tried to take a statistical count of, I can't remember what that was.
Well, it was easier when Apple wasn't as big as they are today, but what we could do is go back and we would, on Black Friday, we would go and post outside of several Apple stores around the country. I have different people that I work with. And then we would count the number of items that were coming out. We could be able to see what people were buying. And then we would compare that year over year in the same store. Mm-hmm. And so there was some, even though you could say, looking at four stores, how does that give you a pulse in terms of how Apple's going to do during the holiday season? Well, in reality, there is some information there that is helpful in looking at the growth and store over store. If, for example, a lot more iPhones are being sold or a lot less, and so that's one small example. We've become more sophisticated in how we do surveys now, and we can, by using different third parties, we can do bigger surveys. But we still, one of the things we're still known for is just doing that feet on the street and actually going out and talking to consumers. One area that we've been doing more work on recently has been an easy area to do and research, which is virtual reality. And so we have different setups of VR gear, whether it's a developer's version of Oculus or Samsung Gear VR, and we'll take that into the street and ask people questions about it and try to get a flavor of, is this a theme that's actually going to take off? But those type of things are parts that I'm just really passionate about, just getting out there and getting in front of people. And surprisingly, from small samples, you can learn a lot about user behavior that can impact these stories.
Cool. Well, I'm going to spring a jackpot question on you now with a smile. Okay. How did you come to believe that Apple would build its own TV set? What were the sources and the leads that made that a thing for you?
I don't even remember the year, but we had met with somebody in the TV industry, I would say, and they had, I would just say it was one of the major manufacturers, TV manufacturers, and they had talked about losing people to go and work at Apple. And I followed up through some of my back channels and found out that that was the case. And that allowed us to know that they were working on the project. One of the mistakes that I made was that I believe that because they were putting a lot of effort and resources behind building the TV, hiring different people, trying to work on different content packages, that ultimately would lead to a product. And then part of that mistake was, in my mind, it had filled a logical space in Apple's products, in that the living room hadn't been as impactful, and that they do a good job of taking a commoditized product like a smartphone or a music player and adding their software to it and increasing the value dramatically, and that design is also a part of the feature. And so it all started from people working in the industry that were getting hired away, and this is kind of even before LinkedIn was taken off and you could really track this as easily, and taking that piece and kind of thinking it logically through.
Do you think Apple should build its own display, or do you think they're on the right track with the Apple TV Gen 4?
It's almost such a painful topic for me because I was so wrong on it. I haven't given as much thought. At the end of the day, I always thought Apple should. Yeah, to me, I think there's a market for it. I think that's something that they should do. I don't think it's something that's on their current product roadmap. I think their approach to TV is to continue to work with the current hockey puck, and then separately is to try to get some of these content deals done.
Why do you think that the Apple TV Gen 4 omitted 4K support? Do you think there's another product coming soon that will do that, or Apple didn't feel like the market was ready? What are your perspectives on that?
I think it's probably more another product is on its way, and ultimately is that you're going to probably see Apple start to revise a lot of its product roadmaps in the fall. Historically, they've done a lot of the updates throughout the year, but we think they're going to move to this pattern of September announcing a lot of things, in particular about the 4K support. I don't have a good read on that. We've got a decent read on some other products that are going to come out in the fall, but don't have a strong opinion on that.
You know, the fall is where we think Apple's coming out with another, a new version of the Apple Watch. And I know you've suggested that this is going to be the year of the Apple Watch. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we've thought 2016 is the year of kind of building momentum around the watch. I think that 2017 is the year where it really breaks out. And what has to happen is they have to decouple the watch from the phone. Mm-hmm. And that may be mid to late next year. It's hard to say, but we think that the limitation right now is the battery. But that opens up the use case dramatically as far as how people can get value out of a wearable if they did decouple it. And so that's what we're waiting on, is to see some improvements in the battery that will ultimately allow them to put a radio, is the term that people use,
sure,
or think of it as putting LTE into your watch. And so that's on the roadmap, and we're hopeful that it's going to be sometime in 2017.
They're going to have a really good advance in battery technology to support that.
Or potentially a bigger form factor, too. That's another...
Really? You think the Apple Watch could get any bigger?
Well, there's preference differences between men and women. And one thing you cannot have is a watch that the radio works with a man's watch and not
right.
a women's watch.
Right.
And so to answer your question, there needs to be some dramatic improvements in the watch or the battery life to make that happen.
Right.
You are correct.
Right. How about the iPhone SE? Is it selling as well as you thought it would, or as Apple hoped it would?
I think it's off to a good start, but a good start doesn't move the needle. And they disclosed that in 2015, 12% of the iPhones that were sold were the same screen size as the SE, that smaller form factor. And so this tends to be a smaller part. They were a little bit more aggressive in lowering their price by about 11%, which is going to make it slightly more attractive to price-sensitive consumers in emerging markets. So I think that this could have an effect of accounting for maybe somewhere between 10 and 15% of overall iPhone units, and it's going well and will achieve that, but it's still pretty small in the grand scheme of the overall iPhone business.
Yeah, it kind of fills in the competitive gaps, I think.
Yep.
All right. Well, Joel, only got a few minutes left, and now I want to get on to the real jackpot question for you. We've heard endless rumors about the Apple Titan project, hires from Tesla, noises coming from factories, parts being bought, filings with the government on various pieces of equipment they have to run. Are you convinced that Apple's going to build and retail a electric car?
This is kind of an easy way out because I was wrong on the TV. I am holding off on definitively saying that they're going to actually have a car. We do know that, as everyone does, that they are working on an actual car. They could also take the avenue of embedding a lot of technology in a car, but we don't think that that's going to be the approach. So I think that the goal right now is that they want to launch a car. Some of the timing has been suggesting it could be as early as a car that we can actually see by 2019 or 2020. Mm-hmm. That seems a little bit optimistic. I would say that there is enough evidence that this is going to see the light of day. If I was going to have to make a bet, I would say that it probably does see the light of day. And part of it is because the car hasn't really changed in 100 years. And this is a huge addressable market. There's, call it 60 or 70 million cars sold globally every year. And for a company like Apple has a lot of revenue, call it more or less $250 billion in revenue, it's hard to grow that. And that's a big company problem. And you need to go after large addressable markets that can be transformed. And so autos lines up on a lot of those factors, even though it seems wildly outside of their core competency. It actually does line up on some of those other levels. And so we're optimistic that they will eventually have a car, and keeping track closely of all the news that's coming out along the way.
Do you think that Apple's organizational structure that suited it well when it was a $10 or $100 billion company is up to the task of managing being a leader in the automotive industry? The executive team is rather small, and it's functionally designed. So now Tim Cook, who doesn't have a lot of experience with car business, now has to hire somebody who's responsible to him to take on something that's just really a big challenge. Do you think Apple's organizational structure is going to be able to handle this transition into the car industry?
I think they have to, because I think that they, we're talking about something that is 5 years potentially away from actually being able to be purchased. And so I think today that's not the case. I think the organizational structure is not up to the task. I think that with some of the right hires and the amount of money that they're spending on R&D, which has been increasing as a percent of sales, that they can get there. And it's an optimistic view, but this is a dramatically different scale of a problem than when they went from iPods, for example, to the phone.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that there's been, as they've moved down the road, back from when they originally came out with the iPod, could they have a successful music business? Again, a car is very different than a device, and so this is orders of magnitude difference. But the idea of them having enough competency to pull off a new category has been part of the story, and they've surprised us in the past and delivered. And so I'm a believer that we're going to look back in 5 years and think that Steve Jobs held Apple back.
Wow. Amazing. Well, guess what? I think we're just about out of time. And that's a very good place to end on that upbeat note about Apple and cars. I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It's been great. Gene, tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Send me an email. My email address is gene.a.munster@pjc. That's gene.a.munster@pjc.com. And if you could just put the Mac Observer in the subject line to make sure I flag it and get back to you.
Cool. Well, thanks again for being on the show. This was delightful. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.